From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
After years of promises, Republicans fill in the blanks. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. The new House tax reform bill is supposed to save money for typical Americans. Here's Speaker Paul Ryan with the magic number.
$1,182 a year on their taxes.
That might sound like a lot to you, or it might sound like a little. In either case, the battle between special interests is already underway. The stakes are high for the rich, the very rich, the middle class, and the poor. For red states and blue states, for businesses big and small. And that $1,182 typical saving, that will be subject to change. We'll hear much more today. On our talking point later, after Weinstein, a real awakening? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Mormon Olney back with To the Point. After failing to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, President Trump and Republicans in both houses of Congress want reform of another kind before Christmas. Will they be able to pass their massive tax cut program that soon? What's at stake for next year's elections? Today's talking point, it's been a month since stories of sexual harassment, including rape and assault, by Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein began to pour forth, unleashing a deluge of such reports from Hollywood to Sacramento to Washington, D.C. Will the movies or politics or the news industry see a real change or go back to business as usual? First, this news update. At Fort Bragg, North Carolina today, a shocked courtroom heard a military judge sentence Sergeant Bo Borgdahl, who pleaded guilty to deserting his post in Afghanistan. He faced life behind bars. The prosecution asked for 14 months. Instead, Borgdahl received a dishonorable discharge, a fine of $10,000, and no jail time at all. Alex Horton covered the trial for The Washington Post. He was in the courtroom today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
There were a lot of people in there, I gather. How did they respond?
Well, it was there was a lot of commotion, I think, you know, from the defense attorney, Gene Fidel. You know, the judge walked in, you know, promptly at about 11:32, and he sat down. He read his sentence very quickly. There was a, I think, a lot of the reporters in the public gallery were kind of shocked that, you know, he did not receive any jail sentence. You know, then Fidel, you know, had some words about some kind of proceedings for the appeals court. And then the judge quickly disregarded them and walked out and adjourned the court. So it was over very quickly for how long this has been going on. And, you know, there was Borgdahl had this visible look of kind of shock and I think some relief. And a member of his defense team, you know, openly wept in relief. After they sat back down.
You mentioned appeal. Could the sentence, in fact, be increased?
No, the sentence can only be reduced at this point. The military justice system does not allow for decisions to be upgraded after that or, you know, made more severe. It can only be reduced. So he would either, you know, an appeals court, which is automatic in this case, will look at everything, his fine, his reduction in pay, and also his the characterization of his discharge. The characterization of the discharge, though, is very important because he has a dishonorable one now, which means he won't be able to receive VA care, VA benefits like the GI Bill, anything like that. So, you know, when he goes forward with an appeal, they will try to knock that discharge down to bad conduct discharge, which can at some point he can be eligible for VA benefits, though it takes some doing.
During last year's campaign, the candidate Donald Trump accused Borgdahl of treason, and Borgdahl said this about his chances of getting justice.
We may as well go back to kangaroo courts and lynch mobs that got what they wanted. The people who are to the point of saying, yeah, just shoot them, you can never convince those people to change their minds.
Today, the president tweeted, a total disgrace to our country and to our military. Alex Horton, back to you. Again, did the president's statements, do you think, have any impact on the judge? Is that one of the reasons the sentence was as light as it was?
Well, we don't know. And Fidel, when you talked to press outside following the sentencing, he did not say, you know, if he understood the different things that the Colonel Jeffrey Nance weighed, because he didn't explain those things. He just revealed his sentence. But Trump did loom very large over the sentencing period of the last couple of weeks. There was a motion to dismiss the case entirely over what's called unlawful command influence, which is, you know, simply everyone who, from the judge to the general who ordered the court-martial, they all answer to the commander-in-chief, which is Trump. So there were concerns among the defense team that they would just follow his cues because he is ultimately their boss. Today, before Trump tweeted, maybe about an hour before that happened, Fidel was outside and he said that he thinks there's grounds to dismiss the case right now, even before Trump tweeted that, you know, there's some clear influence going on. You know, he called it one of the most preposterous events in American legal history. So now he might even have more fuel to have the case dismissed in the appeals court.
What do you think the feeling is behind the scenes among the military? You've been part of that community in the past.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very complicated issue, you know, among, you know, folks who are serving at that time. You know, at Fort Bragg, it doesn't even feel like that this thing is going on. You know, a lot of the troops you encounter and those who have been on the security detail, you know, they weren't even enlisted at the time of this whole thing.
This happened 8 years ago. He was he left the post. He was then captured by the right. Taliban, apparently, and then held for 5 years, brutally tortured by the Haqqani network in Pakistan. So he's been through a lot.
He's been through a lot. And, you know, I'm a veteran myself, so I've seen a lot of commentary from friends and those who are still very much connected to the community. There's a lot of frustration with this. A lot of people thought he should at least receive some jail sentence. But, you know, it's a very strong reaction among the community.
All right. Alex Horton now with The Washington Post. Great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In a moment, after years of promises, Republicans fill in the blanks. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll name back with To the Point. House Speaker Paul Ryan calls the new Republican tax cuts a windfall for the middle class. Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has other ideas.
They have started to unveil a tax bill designed to plunder the middle class in order to put into the pockets of the wealthiest 1% more money.
Aaron Lorenzo reports on taxes and tax reform for Politico. Good to have you on our show.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So this has been much awaited. It was delayed for a couple of days before it was finally revealed yesterday. What's next?
What's next is there are a couple of things. So on the House side, the committee that puts together tax bills begins what's called a markup. They start to consider potential changes. That'll take place throughout next week. And we have yet to see the Senate's version of a tax bill that also is expected next week, probably in the latter end of things.
Don't bills like this have to originate in the House?
You're right. But under the Constitution, revenue measures, a.k.a. a tax bill, has to originate in the House. That doesn't mean that the two chambers are in lockstep. So the House is moving first. The House will advance its bill and pass it first. That sends things over to the Senate, which members there certainly have different ideas. ultimately, they try to iron out those differences and send something, a singular bill, of course, to the president for signature.
Tell us some of the special interests that are going to be standing in line outside the committee room waiting to testify all next week.
Well, there's a couple of flashpoints that came up pretty quickly that you can see, and you can imagine that those interests will be involved in trying to reshape what they see as potentially painful right now. Real estate isn't real happy with what they saw. There's a proposed reduction in the limit on mortgage interest that a homeowner can take. It's currently a $1 million loans, or interest on $1 million loan, up to $1 million loan, is deductible under current law. The House bill would cut that in half, take it down to $500,000. There's also a new idea for deducting property taxes that would put a $10,000 limit on that. Real estate interests aren't too thrilled with those two ideas.
Would those things be applied to current loans and current tax bills, or to those in the future?
Yeah, so what exists now would get grandfathered in. So it would, assuming that this bill would become law this year, it would be on a going-forward basis starting in 2018.
How about the manufacturers? How do they feel about this?
I think the initial feeling from manufacturers is positive. They weren't among the groups to raise their hand yesterday and raise big red flags or anything. So most of the at least the big representatives for the manufacturing community here in Washington are lined up on the positive side. Also in the business world, one of the major small business advocacy groups, the National Federation of Independent Business, or NFIB, came out against this bill yesterday. They're concerned that members of NFIB, which is typically a Republican-aligned, Republican-supporting organization, they are concerned that a lot of their members could actually end up with bigger tax bills under this bill.
How is that? We have to go into the weeds pretty deeply. I don't want you to necessarily do that because people have a hard time following it. But just quickly, why would a Republican organization like that be against this bill?
Sure. So I'll try to be not too technical here. The bill proposes effectively a split in how business income would be taxed. And the split is a 30%, 70% split. So businesses that are not corporations, they're called pass-throughs, and there's a whole host of types of businesses that are called pass-throughs, they would get a tax rate of a maximum 25% on 30% of their profits. The remaining 70% would be taxed at ordinary income rates. And those ordinary income rates could go as high as 39.6% under this Republican bill, which is the current top rate, too. So the NFIB, who I mentioned a minute ago, that group is concerned that a lot of its members would see a lot of their income still up near 40%, still taxed up near that 40% number.
Okay. If, in fact, there is a Republican organization with a significant number of members and presumably some clout in Congress, then that could well endanger the bill. I want to go to our next guest, who's Felicia Wong. She's president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. That's a liberal economic think tank. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What about the interests that you represent, and will they be lining up outside the door next week?
Well, I think it's important to remember that at the heart of this plan, we're going to hear a lot of debate about the middle class, and that's, of course, very important. But it's important to remember that the heart of this plan is really about corporate tax cuts. The proposal is to take corporate cuts from a 35% rate to a 20% rate. That is a massive cut. And of course, the Republicans have promised falsely that this is going to lead to growth. This is, dare I say, this is a kind of fantasy, because we have seen this happen over and over again, and we know that it actually leads to a lot of stagnation and a lot of pain. In 2012 in Kansas, we saw these kinds of cuts lead to radically growth in that state. In 2004, we tried this with a corporate tax holiday, and what that really led to was corporate stock buybacks and really not the kinds of growth and job growth in particular that the Republicans are, again, falsely promising. So I think this is a huge problem, and this will not bring any kind of relief to the middle class.
Would you call this trickle-down economics, which we've heard about since the Reagan administration?
This is absolutely a doubling down of trickle-down. You're absolutely right. It's also important to remember from a political perspective that, this kind of tax policy has been central to the Republican and to the conservative identity since the 1970s, but we really know it hasn't worked. It's a seductive kind of logic that tax cuts are going to lead to more investment, but actually what we see is that tax cuts on the top, tax cuts on corporations in particular, lead to actually higher CEO pay, higher executive pay, so more for the top, and really very little job creation.
So, Aaron Lorenzo, back to you with Politico. We heard earlier that there are some Republican organizations that, at least at the moment, don't like this bill very much. I gather from what we heard from Felicia Wong, it's not going to get any Democratic support at all.
Well, certainly on the House side, I don't think you'll find any House Democrats lining up on the support side, right? Not right now, definitely. On the Senate side, the White House and President Donald Trump are pressuring certainly a handful of Senate Democrats who they think they could bend on this ultimately. It's too early to call that, I would say, but it's easy to point out who those senators are. They're senators who are up for re-election this current cycle. They're facing re-election next November, a year from now. And they are in states that President Trump not only won, but won by a pretty wide margin. So on the Senate side, you can see that there will be White House pressure to try to get some Democrats to buy into this bill.
Let me introduce Peter Morici. He is an economist and professor emeritus at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Been on our program many times. Peter Morici, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you.
What do you say to what we have heard, particularly with regard to Republican concerns about this bill? Do you think, in fact, that this is trickle-down economics, that it has been proven not to work, and that that's basically the problem, even though Republicans might not want to come out and say so?
Well, if I'm selling ice cream and the price of an ice cream cone at my stand is $3 and the price of an ice cream cone at the stand next to me, say 100 yards down the boardwalk, is $2 because he pays lower taxes than I do, I'm at a disadvantage. The world has changed a lot over the last 20 years. And throughout Europe, what liberals would view as progressive governments have been essentially cutting their corporate taxes and been realigning how they tax. And as a consequence, our corporate tax is now not the 35%, but the effective rate that companies actually pay on average is a lot higher. Now, in terms of how much this actually cuts corporate taxes, it would be about 20%. That is 20% of the take. It would go from about $350 billion, and we'd take off, $75 billion a year. That's largely to stay competitive. The problem with corporate tax cuts in the past is they've been done at times of distress. The economy's got a problem. They've been short-term. So we get conflated with what we see. There's a lot of variables working. There's always a lot of variables working when you implement any economic policy so as to tease out the results. Now, in terms of trickle-down economics being an absolute failure, gee whiz, the economy never grew over the last generation like it did during the Reagan years. And that lasted well into the Clinton years because of his tax cuts and other pro-growth policies that are
Didn't that have an awful lot to do with the military buildup?
No, I don't think so. There was enormous private sector innovation. that had very little to do with the military. One of the fallacies is this notion that if you spend money on the military, you generate growth beyond it just making more bombs. A very long time ago, military and civilian technologies diverged. I mean, you might get it going the other way. You know, civilian technologies, handheld devices, find their way into uses in the military. But no, I don't think so. No.
Okay. Well, let me go back to Felicia Wong on the issue of the ice cream analogy that we heard earlier, and what European progressive governments are doing, and how they are lowering the corporate tax, whereas ours remains very high. What do you say to that?
Well, actually, many studies show that our effective rate is far lower than 35%. It's somewhere in the mid-teens. But at any rate,
What do you mean by the effective rate as opposed to the rate?
The rate that corporations actually pay, as opposed to the rate that they once all deductions are taken into account.
Okay.
But at any rate, what I wanted to say is that, you know, it's very important to look at the data. And, you know, the most recent research from Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez and their colleagues, a woman named Stephanie Snacheva, shows this is 50 years of data across 18 developed countries, the European countries, of course, included. And it really, the most recent research, empirical research, really shows that tax cuts don't bring growth. So I think the claim that Professor Morici is making is just hard to substantiate.
Mr. Morici, a quick response, if that's possible, to a complicated question.
There's stacks of studies that show that the elasticity between the tax, the effective tax rate. I'm not talking about the actual statutory rate. I mentioned that in my comments. It was a red herring to then raise the effective rate again. That the rate that businesses pay and the level of investment is connected. There is an elasticity. Look at it this way. If we put a 100% tax on corporate profits, would anybody invest? I don't think so. It's not a matter of whether we have a corporate tax. It's where we set it to maximize, the amount of investment we get and ultimately the amount of revenue we receive.
Okay, let me go back to Aaron Lorenzo, our first guest, tax reporter for Politico. Are these the kinds of arguments we're going to be hearing next week as the committee meets and the various interests come forward? Is this the sort of thing that politicians want to know about, or have they already made up their minds?
Well, you better believe you're going to hear a lot of these arguments. Have politicians already made up their minds? More than likely, yes. The Republicans at their press conference yesterday or in the hallways around the Capitol today, I mean, they'll tell you over and over and over again how the economic benefits of this package are going to just outweigh any potential costs that are being estimated up front. They truly believe that this is a salve, and this is going to lead to sustained economic growth of 3% or more a year. On the Democratic side, there is more than a healthy dose of skepticism about that kind of growth projection.
So we can predict fairly well the House vote in favor of the bill because of the majority of Republicans there. But again, as you indicated, questions in the Senate. You said there's a handful of Democrats, people running for reelection in states that were won big by President Trump. Quickly, their names?
Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Joe Manchin, West Virginia. That's four there. There's probably a couple more that are escaping.
Okay, and that's enough to pass the bill if, in fact, they all were to go to the way of the Republicans. Aaron Lorenzo, it's great to have you on our program, and thanks very much for being with
us.
Thank you. We're going to continue our program with Felicia Wong and Peter Morici. We'll also talk with Rachel Schneider of the Center for Financial Services Innovation on our talking point later after Weinstein, A Real Awakening. We'll talk about that. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point. We've been hearing some of the arguments for and against the tax bill that the Republicans began to announce yesterday. Hearings are coming up next week. The Senate has yet to draft its own bill, and we don't know what might be coming out of that. But we do know this, that the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, announced yesterday that this bill, as he put it, would save enough money for what he referred to as typical Americans, that's a family of four, $1,182 a year. Rachel Schneider is Senior Vice President at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. That's a nonprofit financial services consultancy that focuses on unbanked and underbanked consumers. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
$1,182. What do you make of that number as applied to what the speaker referred to as a typical American, if there is such a thing?
Well, I think it's not big enough to be really as meaningful as it should be. If we're really going to help the middle class, then you've got to think about bigger dollar numbers.
How much bigger?
Oh, that's a tough question. There's two issues people are going to talk about, the how big and also whether or not it's a refundable tax credit. And so the how big question, you know, what's a big enough number, it sort of goes back to the conversation that you were having right before the break around, like, how much are we focusing on corporate tax breaks here relative to individual tax breaks? And there's no doubt that the plan that's being put forward really leans heavily towards helping corporations relative to helping people.
What about the people that you deal with and the people for whom $1,182 might make a difference? How many of them are there?
Well, you know, I just recently completed a research project called the U.S. Financial Diaries with Jonathan Mordock of NYU. And in that work, we looked really deeply into the financial lives of 235 American households. And what we saw was really a story of volatility. So what you see now is, you know, and you always hear talk about how the economy is changing, the decline of manufacturing jobs. The way that plays out for lots of people is that they don't have really any cushion between what they earn and what they need to spend. The Federal Reserve has put out this number about how less than half of Americans can easily come up with $400 if an emergency comes up. And we really saw the result of that when we talked to the families that we got to know through the Diaries Project.
Less than a half of the families in America can come up with $400, and that was a finding of the Federal Reserve?
Exactly. The other half, about, you know, another 40% can come up with it if they borrow. Another 15% or so say they just don't have any way to get that amount of money. And so in that context, a tax refund plays a huge role in people's lives. And there's been really almost a decade now of research about how people use their tax refunds and how important that moment is when you get that check in the mail. And for a lot of families, that is the one moment in the year when they have enough money to fix their car or get a slightly better car or put down a down payment on childcare for the year or make a big expenditure. And so that we really can't underestimate how important tax refunds are to people's financial health.
And are you equating the tax refund with what the speaker called a typical savings of $1,182?
You know, yeah, I am. You know, or I'm saying, you know, that when we think about what amount we want people to be able to get in that check or what amount we want them to be able to not have to spend on taxes, he's talking about $1,000. And I think that's a fine start for some families. But what he doesn't point out is that for lower income families, they're really not going to be helped as much as they could be.
Peter Morici, let me go back to you. Once again, our economist, Professor Emeritus, Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. If we have so many people in the situation we just heard described, what does this bill do for them? And aren't they as important as other Americans?
Well, they are as important. And on a proportionate basis, they're getting more of a tax cut. You have to remember that, you know, over 80% of the income tax is paid by the top 25%. It's more like about 87% is paid by the top 25%. Unlike in Europe, the middle class and working class are not heavily taxed to pay for government services and so forth. If you receive an Obamacare subsidy, then you don't pay much health care either. You know, in Europe, a Danish school teacher will tell you that, well, her kids go to college for free and she gets free health care and so forth, but which she will also tell you she pays half her income in taxes. That's not the case here. So the tax system is already fairly progressive. In terms of whether this is slanted towards corporations or individuals, at some point we have to address the corporate tax. All the previous tax cuts going back 25 years, tax measures and so forth, have focused on individuals. The rest of the world's been cutting corporate taxes. This bill is evenly divided. About $75 billion is addressed on the corporate side, and about $75 billion is on the personal side. Let's also be mindful that this bill would make life a lot simpler for most Americans. Most Americans would file a short form. That is, they would not have to deal with the complexity of the tax code or record keeping and things like this. You know, when we argue about the mortgage interest deduction and the Republicans, you know, propose to cut its availability, that's something that's taken by the very well off these days. So my feeling is that there is some help for these people. But, you know, if you're only paying $2,000 a year in taxes, cutting it in half is a pretty good deal.
Felicia Wong, back to you with the Roosevelt Institute, our liberal economic think tank. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, two things. First of all, it's not at all clear to me that this is going to help middle earners or working families. Some early calculations suggest that all of the changes in the tax code altogether, and Professor Morici is right, there are a lot of changes, but it looks like those changes would actually raise taxes on almost 13 million tax filers who earn less than $100,000 a year. So middle class and working class. So that is really something to look out for as this debate unfolds. That's on the numbers. And then on the politics, I would just say that, you know, I am not sure that even conservative or pro-Trump voters are feeling so great about this plan right now. A recent survey by a progressive group called Not One Penny suggests that 60% of respondents said that they thought the plan was going to benefit the wealthy more than the middle class, and only 20%, 2 in 10, said that they were going to benefit themselves. So this is, you know, everyone's trying to say that this plan is going to benefit the middle class. Whether or not Trump voters and those voters who are in Heidi Heitkamp's district or Joe Manchin's state, whether they believe that, that remains to be seen.
Those, again, Democratic senators up for reelection in Republican states. Rachel Schneider, back to you. A comparison has been made to Europe. In this country, it's often remarked that there is a huge concentration of wealth at the very top of the financial hill, if you will. What's the situation in Europe? How do we compare in that regard? And respond, if you will, to what Peter Morici said about the fact that they pay so much of their income in taxes in order to get the benefits that they receive from the state.
You know, I think it's a tough comparison. Like, it doesn't feel apples to apples to me at all. Yes, people pay more taxes, but they get more from the state. So it's more, to me, it's not clear to me why that's a bad thing. And certainly Americans feel an incredible amount of financial insecurity and don't currently trust government or their employers or others to help them solve that. And that seems like a really critical, foundational challenge that we have to deal with.
Are Europeans feeling financially secure? It seems to me we're hearing, beginning to hear, that similar kinds of divisions exist in Britain and France and Germany and other countries as well.
it's complicated, right? So people are feeling a whole range of things that we can't put all onto economics. And it's not really, we can't really say, well, it's only that people are feeling financially insecure, and so that explains all of their voting behavior or all of the unrest that you're seeing around the U.S. and Europe. But I do think that what we've seen is a really remarkable transition where risk, economic risk, is increasingly borne by individual families rather than by broader institutions. So in the U.S., there's, you know, a long-term trend away from pensions and towards 401ks, away from employers paying the full cost of health care towards employees paying larger percentages of their health care costs, a trend towards part-time and contract work. All of those trends represent a shift of risk from broader institutions onto individuals, and that is going to naturally lead to an increased feeling of insecurity. So I don't think we solve all the world's ills by tackling tax policy, but I do think that we have to take seriously the level of economic insecurity that American families feel today. And when we look then at this tax plan, gauge whether or not it does anything to help.
So, Peter Morici, if that's the case, why are you so concerned about corporations? Why do they need help?
Well, because we've seen an exit of American companies. They literally are going abroad and reestablishing themselves there because the taxes are so high here relative to other places. That's a reality. The effective tax rate, for example, as computed by the European Union and tax economists at major universities, indicates that our effective rates, what companies actually pay, are considerably higher. We also have a lot of distortions with regard to that. I mean, there are companies running around paying 32, 33, 34, 35% of their profits in taxes, while others pay very little. And this bill does can't fix all of that, but it does fix some of that. Also, it's going to impose some disincentives on corporate raiders, for example. The private equity crowd won't be able to deduct all their expenses in the form of interest in this, and I think that's a good thing. I'm disappointed, you know, in the bill that it didn't do more to curb those characters, because I don't know what they contribute to wealth. But, you know, it is what it is. My feeling is that this tax bill is not perfect, that it's an improvement. And the ideology that we've heard from the other panelists has been pursued rather aggressively over the last 8 years. And as a consequence, the economy grew at about 2%. So it's time to try something different. And while they might not like Mr. Trump, there's something that liberals have to reckon with. The Republicans now hold 34 governorships. The Democrats have been losing a lot of executive branch elections for a reason. The kind of insecurities that we just described did not happen this last January. This last January happened because those economic securities were present. And we do need to try different things. More tax and redistribute is not the way to grow the economy. We simply have to create incentives to invest in the United States because investing is not happening.
So, Felicia Wong, back to you. Identified your organization, the Roosevelt Institute, as a liberal one. We often are criticized on our program for failing to do that and saying that some people are conservative and not saying anything about the others. How do you respond to what Mr. Morici just said, and what does this have to do with the last 8 years of the Obama administration and what he attributes to the situation we heard described by Rachel Schneider?
Well, I actually really agree with Peter on one thing in particular. I think it's essential that our private sector and our companies are healthy and are investing in jobs. I think all Americans across the political spectrum would agree that more job creation would help blunt the kind of economic anxiety and the kind of economic insecurity that Rachel referenced. However, the evidence that I look at tells me that the way to get corporations to invest more in jobs is actually to incentivize them with the right tax rate to actually invest in product development and in wages and in training. What we see now with very high tax rates, with very low tax rates, is actually corporations and corporate executives spending more on stock buybacks, which means buying back their own equities in order to up their price, their stock prices, and boost their own pay. We see a lot more of that now than we did 30 years ago.
Well, are you saying that we have a low corporate tax rate at the moment? Mr. Morisi and many Republicans are saying it's the highest in the world.
Well, I would like to see it actually at least maintain or possibly or potentially higher in order to create this different incentive effect on corporate executives.
All right. We obviously have a vast difference of
we might have
opinion
to agree
on
to
that
disagree.
One. Yeah.
But it's very important. This is not redistribution and is not tax and spend. It is really about trying to get the tax rate right so that our corporations are throwing off good, high-quality jobs.
So, Rachel Schneider, what do you say to the argument that this tax bill will encourage companies to stay in this country, will encourage them to invest, and to create jobs?
You know, I can't really speak to that. The work I've done is really about the personal financial lives of families. And so what I hear in all of these debates is, as always, a completely different read of the data, a variant read of the data. And so what I'm really more focused on is the piece about what are we doing directly for families, because that's where the data that I spent my time analyzing and collecting leads me.
Did the Obama administration do well in that regard?
I think that the Obama administration advanced, consistently thought about how they could advance the lives of struggling working families. Did they succeed in all ways? Nobody did, and I absolutely think that there's some systemic and structural things happening in our economy that nobody's really figured out how to solve.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. We've gotten a sense of what's going to be debated over the next weeks, and we'll see what happens when the Senate begins to chip in as well, or chime in, rather. And thank you all very much for being on our program. Rachel Schneider, again, is Senior Vice President of the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Peter Morisi is an economist and professor emeritus at the University of Maryland. Felicia Wong is CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. And our earlier guest, Aaron Lorenzo, is a tax reporter for Politico. Great to have you all. Many thanks for being with us. In a moment, will Harvey Weinstein's downfall have lasting repercussions? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're not here with today's talking point. It's been a month since public allegations of sexual harassment, including assault and rape, began against the movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. Since then, a flood of accusations has tarnished a host of Hollywood titans, political figures from Sacramento to Washington, D.C., and at least one executive at National Public Radio. All that, of course, in addition to Fox News, which you heard about before. I want to introduce Ann Friedman. She's a co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, and she's a contributor to the L.A. Times and New York Magazine as well. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Do you think that this is a flash in the pan, or is this something that is going to continue for time to come?
I think it's hard to say right now. Certainly the volume of stories that we're reading and the sustained attention that this issue is getting feels different than anything that I've seen in my lifetime or since I've been covering these issues. But I am a little bit skeptical about the possibility of this being a long-term sustained shift in the way abuse and harassment happen or allowed to flourish, or the way the people that perpetrate those things are punished.
Has it, though, gone farther than you anticipated? Did you initially fear that it would end with Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is not the first time that several women have come forward with stories about a powerful man who has repeatedly engaged in abuse and harassment. You know, I mean, we saw Cosby last year. You know, we saw similar scandals in the music industry last year as well. Comedy, I mean, pretty much any corner of certainly the culture industry, but other businesses as well, has been has had its own scandal like this, or its own bad figures. I'm kind of air quoting there, bad figures to point to. You know, for many, many years. I mean, that's not new. I mean, I think that there's a lot of different things happening in a lot of different industries simultaneously. That feels new. And what I'm starting to see and what I'm really interested in is how this conversation is shifting to one that is more about the culture created in various workplaces and industries, and about the complicity of people who are in positions of power but are not, you know, perpetrating this abuse themselves. What are they doing to make sure that the less powerful women and people who work for them are not experiencing this?
Here's an interesting example of what you're talking about, I think, speaking of workplace culture and holding bosses accountable. Here is the host of National Public Radio, Mary Louise Kelly, this week, pressing her boss, the chief executive officer, Jarl Mohn, about why he didn't do more to investigate NPR's top editor, Michael Oreskes, who has now resigned at Mohn's request, but only after it was well known that he had been engaged in this kind of behavior.
You said you can't act on rumors and gossip, but were you concerned that these accusations were creating a toxic environment in the newsroom?
Absolutely, of course. As bad as, you know,
should that not prompt action then?
Well, it did. Ultimately, we informally were asking questions. Clearly, we didn't do everything we could because it didn't result in the right answer. But to suggest we were not doing anything, or we were not acting appropriately, is not, or that we were doing nothing, is false.
And Friedman, back to you. Jarl Mohn, did he give a good account of himself?
Well, first of all, I thought this interview was just stunning, and it was fascinating to listen to someone who was part of a workplace affected by this directly ask her boss, hey, what were you doing? And then for us all to be able to listen to him have to answer for that was pretty stunning and felt new to me. You know, I don't think that his answer is sufficient. I think that the facts speak for themselves, which is to say that after they looked into it, people in the newsroom clearly continued to feel affected by the behavior of this person. Like, the problem did not go away just because there was an informal investigation into what was going on. So I think that this speaks to what I was saying earlier about the need for more of a cultural shift in how we all think about these issues. And frankly, for bosses, it comes down to who you're prioritizing. And I think that that question that you played gets right to the heart of that, because it is not about, what is the letter of the law in our HR policy say? It's about whose safety and comfort do you want to prioritize in your workplace, and what will create a productive, healthy working environment for all of your employees, not just, you know, this one person at the top.
We're told that a lot of people at NPR crowded the hallways in order to try to listen to that interview. And as you indicated, it was unusual in general, but it was unusual for NPR in particular, of course. Another media outlet that's been hit with allegations is the New Republic, a longtime magazine, of course, where the longtime editor, Leon Wieseltier, has faced allegations of inappropriate comments and misconduct. And here's the former editor, Franklin Foer, talking with June Thomas of Slate about whether he spoke up when sexual comments were made.
As you were the big boss, did you ever think, wow, this is, you know, what were you thinking? Okay, you said you didn't intervene. Why didn't you? And like, what was your role in all of this?
You know, confrontation is hard, I think. Yes. is part of the grand moral of this entire story, and I wish I shrouded myself in doing the right thing and being confrontational in those instances. But really, I was just profoundly uncomfortable.
And Friedman, back to you. Profoundly uncomfortable, even he says that's not enough.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that that clip that you played, he's talking about things that were said to him directly by Leon Wieseltier without you know, maybe female employees present. So he wasn't talking about a woman coming to him with allegations of harassment, feeling uncomfortable dealing with that. He was talking about how when his male coworker said something that he found objectionable and distasteful about the women they worked with, he didn't feel comfortable speaking up. And he was technically this person's boss. And I think this speaks volumes about the cultural shift that needs to happen in terms of people who are not harassing women, who are not perpetrating any kind of abuse directly, asking themselves, what am I doing to make sure that others know it's not okay for them to do that? And what am I doing even when women in my office are not listening in? I think those are key questions.
Well, that's one thing if you're the boss, but what if you're not the boss and your boss, in fact, engages in that kind of conversation or that kind of activity? At what point do you feel people ought to speak up, and would they be risking their jobs if they did?
I think it's pretty clear that there's still a great, great risk for speaking up about things like this. You know, when you consider how high the burden of proof is and how often it can be difficult to show in a documented way what you've experienced when it's your word against the word of someone who is much more institutionally powerful. I mean, I will say that I don't think anyone who has experienced harassment or abuse is obligated in some sense to come forward. I think that they need to do what is best for them. And I think the burden really lies on the rest of us to make sure that we are communicating that that behavior is not okay. And we are communicating to people who may have experienced it, that we will take their stories seriously. And, you know, one thing I read that I really loved was with an interview also in Slate with Anthony Bourdain, the media personality and chef, former chef, who is in a relationship with the actor Asia Argento, who is one of the people who have come forward to accuse Harvey Weinstein of assault. And in that interview, Anthony Bourdain was commenting on accusations against a chef that he knows. And he said, listen, I have had to stop and ask myself why I didn't hear about these things sooner. Why am I just hearing about them now? And I think for anyone who is shocked by these allegations within their workplace or their industry, a good question to ask is, why didn't I know? Who didn't trust me before that? And what do I need to do differently so that I'm communicating to people who've experienced this that I will trust and believe them and take them seriously?
Ann Friedman, the co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, contributor to the Los Angeles Times and the New York Magazine as well. Thank you very much for your advice and counsel, as well as for just being on our program. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan-Orr, and Evan Schwartz. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Our managing producer is Evan George. And thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.